Welcome to Morgan Lewis Podcast Central. This is a podcast recording from Morgan Lewis's June 9th, 2016, 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference. Morgan Lewis partners Jed Wider and Timothy Levin shared this 14-part in-depth discussion of U.S. and international advanced hedge fund topics focusing on manager and investor perspectives. Part 13, Tax Updates and the New DOL Fiduciary Rule. Do I care? Richard Zarin, Gene Cogill, and Craig Bittman will discuss tax updates and the new DOL fiduciary rule. Now, on to the podcast.
Hi, I am Richard Zarin. I'm a tax partner at Morgan Lewis in our New York office, and I'm here with Gene Cogill and Craig Bittman, two of my benefits colleagues. And we're going to give you a quick update through some of the particular recent developments. I will start on the tax side. Really, we're just going to hit a few big themes of things that have happened in the last year. One, back in November, was as part of the Bipartisan Budget Act, the introduction of an entirely new set of procedures for doing audits of partnerships. This replaces what was referred to as the TEFRA partnership audit rules, which had been in place since the early 1980s, and that will go into effect starting with tax years 2018 and forward. And it really is an entirely new approach. The problem that had happened, there were several stages. Before the TEFRA rules, it was sort of a free-for-all for auditing partnerships that really happened at the individual partner level. The TEFRA rules created the notion, which you're familiar with from your fund documents, of a tax matters partner, the notion of procedures for having an obligation of that partner to notify other partners about audits. But ultimately, the effect of a tax audit would land at the individual partner level and not at the partnership level. And the IRS, in practice, found it difficult to mechanically audit very many partnerships, and historically has audited very few partnerships. These new rules are intended to give the government the ability to audit more easily. Some of it just procedural. There's now a notion of a partnership representative instead. It doesn't have to be a partner. They get rid of some of the notice requirements, but the more important aspects are that it moves the audit and the responsibility for paying and underpayment of tax in the very first instance to the partnership itself. And that creates an obvious concern. People think of partnerships as pass-throughs, and they don't expect them to have liabilities. And if you're a tax-exempt partner or a non-U.S. partner, you certainly don't expect that your return is being hurt because of taxes paid at the partnership level. These rules will include ability of a partnership, if it acts rather quickly, to push out to its partners the obligation to amend their tax returns. But there are a lot of procedural aspects left uncertain there, including how you're really going to make that work. Let's say in the hedge fund context, where you have hundreds of partners sometimes, and in the context of where your partners are coming and going, with partners who are no longer there, how that works in master feeder structures or very many tiered structures, including fund of funds and down into underlying portfolio partnerships or LLCs, at what level do all these things happen? At this point, really, you get some sense of how much uncertainty there is in terms of how this will all be implemented by just seeing that within, well, one case a day or two ago, with the lead of some of my colleagues in Washington, and last week or so, the ABA Tax Committee, and before that, the New York State Bar Association committees presented reports on what they thought might need to be done to make sense of this. And those already run hundreds of pages, and they're filled with suggestions to the government about, in order to make this something that can be actually implemented and handled, you're going to need to create fairly detailed procedures. So a lot of this amounts to a wait-and-see problem at this point, one rather than one where we can tell you that much. I think that said, it's fair to say that new partnership agreements right now routinely will include provisions that consider the new provisions. They will include greater flexibility for the general partner to be able to decide, am I going to push out tax liabilities to the individual partners or pay at the partnership level? Obligations for partners after they're not partners to be subject to these rules. And then pushback from the limited partners saying, look, I'm tax exempt, I'm foreign, I'm individual, I have a special status. Please do not cause me to have a lower rate of return because of somebody else's problem. And so there will be a lot of pushing and pulling going on considering that. One other thing I'll mention on the hedge fund side that really ties to this is that there's a real heads I win, tails you lose sort of potential. That is, your allocations might be challenged in a way where the government says, well, somebody should have reported more taxable income earlier. You have to pay that tax now. Somebody else should be getting a deduction later. They don't get that benefit until later on. So that gives you some flavor of the issues there. The other topic I wanted to mention is the management fee waiver proposals that came out last summer in proposed form. This is focused in the first instance on a private equity fund and not a hedge fund strategy, which was to reduce the management fees that are paid to the fund manager and give the fund manager, the general partner, in lieu of that, a share of future profits that would mimic what would happen if that money that would have been paid to the manager had been invested in the funds and then there were later profits. The goal there being delay the recognition of income, not have ordinary income up front, ultimately have capital gains instead. But this has relevance for the hedge fund world as well, because the proposals were quite broadly written, and they include potential changes in how profit interests are thought of generally. I think the main point here that I'd note just quickly is that the government has repeatedly said in recent months that within, they originally said by the end of June, maybe now into July, they're planning on issuing some final rules. They also said, we've listened to what the community's been saying, and there will be some changes, but not given a lot of clue what those are. So it's likely that we will have some new concepts to think about very soon. Other than that, I would just mention very briefly a few other themes that you may run into. One also late last year was a tax law change that makes it possible for non-U.S. pension plans to invest in U.S. real property without the U.S. FIRPTA rules applying. The key theme here will be the difficulty, if you do real estate-related investments, of determining whether a foreign pension plan actually qualifies for this new regime. There's some lack of certainty there and developing standards in terms of how you get comfort. Another that may hit funds indirectly have been changes in the related party debt rules, really creating new rules that might recharacterize debt as equity. This came up to fight inversion transactions, but could easily have some implications for fund managers. With that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Last tax slide. This is something perhaps for New York City-based managers of particular interest. So the IRS has long taken the view that if you are a partner and you're providing services to a partnership, you can't also be an employee. You get a K-1 only, you can't also get a W-2. And some partnerships have sort of tried to do an end run around this by creating a single-member LLC below the partnership, and having the partners at the top level partnership also be W-2 employees of the single member LLC down below. And that has some advantages for partners. They'd get withholding, they'd get FICA taken from their wages, wouldn't have to make estimated payments with respect to that compensation. They could participate as employees in the cafeteria plans and other, you know, rank and file plans downstairs at the single member LLC. And also for New York City based managers, unincorporated business tax advantages. You cannot deduct for the purposes of the 4% unincorporated business tax in New York City, any compensation that's paid to a partner, but you can deduct compensation paid to an employee. So there were clear advantages. Now, I think many practitioners were, to say the least, very, very skeptical that this worked, that this somehow got around the IRS view that, you know, if you're a partner, you're a partner, you can't also be a W-2 employee. Of course, single-member LLCs are disregarded for tax purposes. So the IRS has now put the kibosh on that, I think. Under some final and temporary regs, the IRS has said if a partnership is the owner of a disregarded single-member LLC, then the partners of the partnership cannot also be treated as W-2 employees downstairs. K-1 upstairs, and whether the partner offers, provides its services downstairs to the LLC or upstairs to the partner, there's only going to be a K-1. The partner can no longer participate as an employee in the LLC's employee benefit plans. And that's all effective August this year. There's a bit of a transition period for partners who, for example, participate in cafeteria plans downstairs at the LLC. But I think that's actually a clarification that's been long overdue, and I think that that will clarify a position that some firms have been taking.
And one thing I'd say with that is I think that for anyone who was actually trying to take the view that that also helped in the New York City unincorporated business tax, that was, I think, in our view, a quite aggressive position in any event. So you should expect that you may well get a knock on your door even without this revision.
Okay. So now to ERISA, and Craig is going to tell us about the new Department of Labor fiduciary rule that has been getting so much press.
Okay, thank you. So I like that the title of this presentation ends with, do I care? I think the answer is I do. I'm hoping you all do as well. At least after we speak, hopefully you will. So as many of you may know, ERISA has a comprehensive scheme of standard of care and prohibited transaction rules that apply to private pension plans. And then the Internal Revenue Code with respect to IRAs has also a cumbersome set of prohibited transaction rules. And those rules all apply if you are considered a fiduciary. There's three ways under ERISA to become a fiduciary, under the code to become a fiduciary. For purposes of today, we're only talking about one of those prongs, which is if you provide investment advice for a fee, direct or indirect. Now, the DOL in 1975 issued a regulation with a five-part test that made it very difficult in certain circumstances to actually be considered to be providing investment advice and therefore trigger those fiduciary responsibilities. Among those were that it had to be an ongoing relationship, it had to be a mutual understanding between the advisor and the recipient, and it had to be the primary basis of investment decisions. So obviously those are a lot of lawyerly words that you can drive a truck through, and many investment advisors did, through disclaimers and otherwise. So the Department of Labor, through a very tortured process that began in 2010, has looked to and has now issued a final regulation in April that very much expands who will be considered a fiduciary under ERISA. Now, the ongoing relationship, the primary basis of the advice, and the mutual understanding components are all gone. So it's basically if you provide an investment recommendation that's individualized to a participant or an IRA owner, that can now be considered a fiduciary act. Well, so what does that mean? So this is going to have a dramatic effect on broker-dealers, on other advisors of the like who are receiving commission-based compensation. The reason is if you're providing investment advice to purchase a specific investment or to go with a specific investment that you have an economic stake in, well, that's a prohibited transaction under ERISA because you've given advice for your own benefit, okay? Obviously, that's going to be problematic for a lot of broker-dealers, for a lot of other commission-based employees or advisors. The DOL issued a number of prohibited transaction exemptions that they think will result in these commission-based arrangements continuing to be permitted. The problem is those prohibited transaction exemptions are quite cumbersome. All right, so how does this affect the hedge fund space? Well, here's the basic issue. It's very similar. If you're selling to an IRA or to a pension plan, and you provide them with a recommendation that they should consider investing in your fund, and you give them the investment materials, and then you start earning a fee on that fund, you arguably have given investment advice and therefore become subject to the prohibited transaction rules. And when you start receiving those fees, well, you've just committed arguably a prohibited transaction. So you want to make it very clear that you can fall into one of the prohibited transaction exemptions, or that your advice doesn't even fall into advice in the first place as contemplated by the DOL regulations. Jeannie's going to walk us through how you can get out of the scope of the regulation or fall within one of those exemptions in a minute. The other thing that you should be aware of is if you're running a plan asset fund, the regulations also amend a number of existing prohibited transaction exemptions to include what's called a best interest standard. So if you, for instance, use affiliated brokerage in your hedge fund or some other type of exemption that is affected by these regulations, you might have to relook or rework those affiliate relationships to make sure that they are still exempted under ERISA. You've probably heard there are a number of cases out there now trying to overturn this regulation and declare it illegal. There are now 5 cases that have been brought. There was also legislative action brought in both houses of Congress. The president vetoed those yesterday. So we'll have to see if the litigation actually forestalls the implementation of the regulation. But as it currently looks, come sometime next year, you will have to comply with this. Again, so I'll turn it over to Jeannie now to walk through some of those exemptions and how you can hopefully plan around this.
So as Craig mentioned, the difficulty for hedge fund managers with this new DOL fiduciary rule is that your marketing activities could be treated as the provision of investment advice. And it's really a catch-22. If you're providing investment advice in marketing your hedge fund to ERISA plans or to IRAs, if you're providing investment advice, you're a fiduciary, you cannot self-deal, and therefore you can't get the compensation that you would receive from that plan investor once they're in the plan, which is ridiculous. It's a bit like, you know, being a Cadillac salesman and having to think about the best interests of the person to whom you're selling the Cadillac. I mean, that's clearly not something that's intended. So the DOL made some minor concession, we think, to this inconsistency. And they have kindly said that if a plan investor or an IRA, potential investor in your hedge fund, is represented by an institutional fiduciary, then you can market to your heart's content and you will not be treated as providing investment advice. And an institutional fiduciary is a US bank, insurance company, registered broker-dealer, or RIA, registered investment advisor, or in case of, say, a big plan like the IBM pension plan, they're going to have an investment committee. That investment committee has discretionary authority or control over more than $50 million of assets, which, of course, the IBM pension plan committee has. Then that committee is also an institutional fiduciary. So many of the plan investors in hedge funds are going to be large plans who will be represented by an institutional fiduciary or will have a, you know, an investment committee. So I think you're pretty fine there. This will require, you will see in your subscription documents, by April next year there will be new representations from you and from plan investors, shoring all this up, getting representation from the plan investors that they are in fact represented by an institutional fiduciary, and various representations from you also. However, this is not available to IRAs if the IRA does not have an institutional fiduciary advising it. And that is a difficulty because even the most sophisticated IRA owners rarely have somebody who's actually, you know, has discretionary authority or control over their IRA. Normally they will invest it themselves. So it's going to make investing, marketing to IRAs more difficult. I think eventually, the industry will come to some sort of practice as to how IRAs, you know, and IRAs and small plans without these institutional fiduciaries are going to be marketed to. I think either, you know, we'll all exclude that sort of plan. We will allow that plan in only if they can represent that they have an institutional fiduciary behind them. Or we will somehow try and not make any recommendations at all to the potential investor, you know, hand them the PPM and, you know, that's it. Anyway, we'll see how that works out. I'm sure an industry practice will develop. So that's it for us on the DOL rule. I think that's it for this panel.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
To listen to other panels from the 2016 9th Annual Advanced Topics in Hedge Fund Practices Conference, visit our Hedge Fund University at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity. If you have any questions or would like more information on the topics addressed in this podcast, please contact a Morgan Lewis attorney at morganlewis.com. This podcast is provided as a general informational service to clients and friends of Morgan Lewis & Bockius, LLP. It should not be construed as and does not constitute legal advice on any specific matter, nor does this message create an attorney-client relationship. These materials may be considered attorney advertising in some states. Please note that any prior results discussed in the material do not guarantee similar outcomes. Read more about Morgan Lewis and its hedge funds practice at morganlewis.com/hedgefunduniversity.